The Airplane Geeks podcast is proudly sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 220 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I have some co-hosts I'd like to introduce to you. First, we have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening, and welcome to the Airplane Geeks, where it is it's dark here in Chicago, and it's only early evening out here. What happened to summer?
I know. It sort of slipped by before we had a chance to fully enjoy it, I think. Now, Rob, I understand that you're headed to the NBAA convention, the National Business Aviation Association convention in Orlando, Florida.
I am. Yeah, this Saturday I'll be there. The show starts actually officially on Monday, but since I'm filling in for some of the editorial staff at the Aviation International News Magazine press booth.
So, Rob, are you going to bring some Airplane Geeks and Jetwine buttons with you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're always embarrassed when I sit in the press room with Airplane Geeks and Jetwine buttons on, and they try to put me in a corner somewhere where none of the normal people can see me. So we'll see how that goes this year. But it's going to be a lot of fun. Usually 30,000 people show up at the show, so it should be fun.
Let me introduce next David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi, Max. I'm sitting in my workroom. I have my Tamiya F-16 CJ Block 50 in my lap. I've got my chicks dig weasels. Weasels dig chicks in my, you gotta be blanking me stuff. And I'm all ready for a conversation about something I love, and that's weaseling.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in just a second. First of all, let me introduce, we have another guest co-host with us this week. That's Stephen Trimble from Flight Global. Steve writes the Dewline blog, amongst some other things with Flight Global. All right, well, we have a very exciting guest for you this episode. His name is Dan Hampton, and he's the author of Viper Pilot, a memoir of air combat. Now, Dan is perhaps uniquely qualified on this topic. He's now a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who served in the U.S. Air Force for 20 years. Now, Dan flew F-16s, and he's a graduate of the very elite U.S. Air Force Flight Weapons School, a couple other things, too, including Special Operations School. He knows how to fly F-16s in combat, and he's done that many, many times. Dan, it's a real honor to have you on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, I appreciate it very much. It's actually Fighter Weapons School.
Fighter Weapons School, yes. Sorry.
Okay, the martini obviously hasn't kicked in, and if you're going to call me exciting, I wish you were a girl.
Oh, man. David earlier mentioned weasels, wild weasels, and David knows what that is for sure, and the rest of us do now after having read the book. But for our listeners who are unaware of that whole idea, maybe you can just give us a little quick rundown of what is a wild weasel?
The wild weasel program was created back during Vietnam when I was being potty trained in response to Russian surface-to-air missiles that were being supplied to the North Vietnamese. Up until that time, airplanes had faced threats from other airplanes, of course, anti-aircraft artillery, but the idea of something coming at you at twice the speed of sound with a microchip for the brain was kind of new. So we were losing airplanes left and right to it, and the Air Force created the Wild Weasels specifically to deal with it.
All right. Well, we're going to talk a lot about that coming up soon, and we're going to talk a lot about what it's like to fly an F-16 in combat. And we're all very excited about that. David, of course, is extra excited about that. We're going to do that in just a few minutes. First, though, we've got some aviation news from the past week that we're going to talk about. And then we have coming up also Stephen Grant's Australia Desk Report. Stephen Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. They'll give us some aviation items to think about from the Asia-Pacific standpoint. And then we have our European contributor, Peter Johnson, with his Across the Pond segment. We have a few more Grill the Geeks questions. We'll try to see if we can answer those. And then we've got a little bit of listener mail. First, though, let's get started right with the aviation news. So is everyone ready for that?
We're ready.
Oh, yeah.
Our first story comes from CBSNews.com. Hawker Beechcraft sale to Chinese firm collapses. Well, you'll recall some episodes ago, we discussed the sale of Hawker Beechcraft to the Chinese. And this was in a deal that was supposedly worth almost $1.8 billion. Well, the strange fishing expedition, as Richard Abulafia termed it from the Teal Group, it's not going to happen. Apparently, the talks with Superior Aviation Beijing were unsuccessful. And the CEO, Steve Miller, says, quote, "Despite our best efforts, the proposed transaction with Superior could not be completed on terms acceptable to the company. We are disappointed that the transaction did not come to fruition." So this is kind of interesting. Rob, did you think this was ever this ever had a chance of going through?
Well, I don't know if I wondered too hard about whether it had a chance as much as I kind of hoped that it did. Because I think the result now is that when you have a company like Hawker Beechcraft that has, you know, honestly, products that are really old, the King Air's been around for a long time despite having updated it. The Piston line, the Baron, the Bonanza, they're all 50-year-old designs and almost 60 years old, actually. And even their jets are, not quite in there with the rest of the competition. So I guess the big question now is really going to be if Hawker Beechcraft has to go it alone, now what happens? And there's already been talk about completely divesting themselves of the jet line. Getting rid of all the Hawker jets and just simply keeping the King Airs and the Piston airplanes, which means that that airplane or that company is really going to shrink.
But there's also the AT-6s and stuff. So there's a military component that should be able to last out and through the bankruptcy. Don't you agree?
Oh, I think they'll last out. I don't think, in fact, I believe, that's probably one of the bright spots for them is that military side. Off the top of my head, I don't know what percentage of the company's revenue, though, comes from that military side. And, of course, that was never going to be a part of the sale anyway. There was no way the Defense Department was ever going to let that fall into the laps of the folks over there in Asia. So, but again, what's all going to happen now? Boy, it's anybody's guess. And I guess the worst part of it though is that, when you, it's kind of like thinking you had a cool date and then the date calls you up at the last minute and says that they're not coming. In fact, what's really embarrassing, a lot of folks from the city of Wichita were in China to sort of complete the deal and be there as sort of rah-rah to, spur on all the last-ditch efforts. And they had a meeting planned with the Chinese, and it just got suddenly canceled at the last minute without anybody having any idea it was coming. Mm-hmm. And they were there 10,000 miles away from home and all dressed up and nowhere to go.
David, what are these AT-6s that you mentioned?
They're trainers for the United States Air Force.
Are they based on another aircraft?
Based on a Pilatus PC-9.
Oh, okay.
The other thing I was going to say is it's kind of interesting that the two major mergers in the aircraft industry both have fallen apart. This Hawker Beechcraft one, and now we've got the EADS and BAE falling apart too.
Right.
It's sort of It's like all of these people are talking mergers, but when they get down to the nitty gritty, it doesn't happen.
And I guess as part of this one, the company would be renamed, just lose the Hawker part, become Beechcraft Corporation. So,
well, of course, this company's gone through so many iterations between the current one that they almost had was Superior, and then being Hawker Beechcraft, and they were owned by Raytheon for a while, and then they were just Beechcraft Beech Aircraft Corporation. And so it's, you know, changing names is probably something the folks there are getting used to.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to our next story. This is from armedforcesinternational.com. This is U.S. Air Force save Vortex surfing flights, cut fuel use 10%. And in this case, SAVE, which is an acronym, S-A-V-E, where the S is changed into a dollar sign.
Marketing gone astray.
That's right. It stands for Surfing Aircraft Vortices for Energy. So some time ago, when we were talking about how, as I recall, is how you can get the total airliner fuel reduction of around 40%, we mentioned a number of different strategies, possible technologies for doing that. And one of them was this thing called flocking. And the idea is that airplanes would fly together in flocks, the way geese do in a V formation, because that has certain aerodynamic advantages. Well, maybe the Air Force was listening to us, maybe not. But anyway, they tried it with a pair of C-17 Globemasters. And guess what? It worked to the tune of about a 10% fuel burn reduction. The Air Force is calling it vortex surfing, which, I don't know, I think sounds a lot cooler than flocking. What do you think?
Yeah, well, drafting is drafting, but I don't think the Air Force wants to be associated with NASCAR. It makes perfect sense. Flying in a formation, the lead aircraft aerodynamically breaks the air in front of the other aircrafts, making it easier for the aircraft behind to fly. I mean, that's why geese do it.
Right.
It saves energy. So, I mean, my only objection to this article was the fact that they used one of the C-17s as popping flares to make a flare angel, and that had nothing to do with the damn flying in formation to save gas. And besides, the Air Force sort of has been flying in formation to save fuel and stuff for years. It's not new. There's an antenna on top of a C-130 called it SKI, which is a formation radar that locks onto the other aircrafts and keeps the aircraft in formation as it flies across. So nothing new. It's just, okay, well, it's a great way to show that we're green.
Now, I couldn't tell from the article what the proximity of the airplanes was. You know, if it's in order to get this fuel savings, if it's requiring them flying much closer together than they would as you're describing, I don't know.
You need to be in the draft of the lead aircraft, so I would assume that it would be close formation flying. So because you want the lead aircraft to break the air, so that the other aircraft behind it gets the benefit of the disrupted airflow. So, Rob, how close do you think you would need to fly?
I'm thinking it got to be pretty darn close. But, of course, if we're talking C-17s, they have winglets. So you can't get too close. It's not like you can really have one wingtip over the top of the other or anything like that. But still, I'll bet you 20, 30 feet. That's, for those big airplanes, that's really close.
Yeah, you mentioned the winglets. That's kind of interesting. You put winglets on airplanes to reduce the tip vortex, reduce the drag caused by that. And with vortex surfing, I don't know, maybe you want to take the winglets off so that you do create that tip vortex to hitch a ride with. I don't know. So maybe
I don't know what. Would there be benefit flying directly behind in trail?
I don't know, but the geese don't do it, so I'm guessing they've figured out the best way, and that's sort of, you know, in the V formation.
The geese don't have winglets.
That's true, I guess.
Okay, I think the goose is cooked on this story. Let's move on.
All right. We'll move on to another item. This is from AIN Online. CAE and APS partner to deliver upset training to ab initio students. Rob, you were just doing some upset training, weren't you?
Yeah, and luckily I didn't get upset by it much, but no, seriously. What I thought was really interesting about this story, of course, I have to be full disclosure, I wrote the story that we were using as reference here, because I just think that this topic of loss of control is so important that it's hard to imagine that over the years, we've never really taught that much about it to new pilots. The military people always seem to have quite a depth of knowledge about this sort of thing because, of course, they're flying airplanes at God knows what attitude and altitude and all hours of the day and night and weather. But civilian pilots are simply not trained that way. And so we now find that loss of control is probably, well, not probably, loss of control is the biggest risk that we face in flying these days. And we've got to do something. And part of that is what CAE and APS, Aircraft Performance Systems out in Phoenix, have done to try to alleviate. They're teaching significant depth to aerodynamics. And they're also showing people how it really works in an extra out flying, but then also showing them how it works in a simulator, and the fact that they kind of relate it like people learning to fly on instruments. If you learn to fly in a single engine airplane in the clouds, it doesn't really matter. You can go fly another single engine airplane later. You don't learn just what you need in one airplane, and you know that it doesn't cross over. And it's the same way with this upset recovery training that they're teaching, is that they teach you the basics of how to get out of some of these situations. It will transfer to anything that you're flying. And most importantly, I mean, everybody that flies airplanes will get this. The one thing that you can do to get the airplane flying again when it stalls is reduce the angle of attack. And it doesn't matter what attitude you're in, if you're upside down or in a 90-degree bank or whatever, you must reduce the angle of attack in order to get the airplane flying. And that's really what they're trying to teach.
Okay, for the ed initiated, is this just basic spin training, how to recover out of a spin?
That's a very good point. No, it's not spin training, and it is not aerobatic training. The problem that we're facing, look at Air France 447, look at the Buffalo accident. There are dozens of other ones in which pilots simply did not know what to do in order to get the airplane flying again when something occurred that was totally unexpected. And that's the real problem that we're dealing with right now. And so what they did is show us some techniques that work no matter how the aircraft is positioned. But they teach you a cool little tool also that, I forgot what you, not an acronym, but...
Mnemonic?
Sort of a mnemonic, yeah. And essentially, to get you to push the stick, push the wheel, to unload the aircraft, to reduce the angle of attack, add power, roll it back level, and it's amazing the number of situations they put me in after only an hour's training to be able to recover these aircraft. And of course, this is the goal, that just like people that are learning to fly go out and practice landings and takeoffs and other kinds of really basic maneuvers, they're going to keep teaching them about how to recover from some of these unusual attitudes. And right now, at least here in the States, that there has not been that much of an emphasis on that. That's a long answer to a short question, but it's not spin training and it's not aerobatic training.
And this isn't just ground school, right?
Oh, no. Again, it's ground school to explain to you what they're trying to do, and then some time in the aircraft to show you how it works, and they talk you through the whole thing step by step by step. And of course, they all these aircraft now have video recorders in them, so that you can go back and play it later. I have this great video that I'm we're doing some editing on even tonight to have ready to show some of our listeners about how what it looks like in a stall spin accident, the base to final approach stall spin that just kills hundreds and hundreds of people every year, and it you get to see what really happens and why almost no one ever recovers from it, because honestly, when it happens close to the ground, everybody just gets scared to death and they suck the wheel of the stick back into their stomach because they think they're going to die. And what they do is they stall the airplane and then they die.
Hmm. So it sounds like, as in many cases, some knowledge is good, but combine that with training and that's even better, especially if you're a pilot.
Absolutely. And it is amazing that, again, over the last 30 or 40 years of civilian training, we've never taught pilots that. And what's happening is it's showing from all these accidents where people are losing control of the airplane.
Yeah. Okay. Any other news items that we should bring up?
Well, actually, one that just popped up here from Oshkosh. News came today that Rod Hightower is out as the boss, and we'll just say it was probably for personal reasons, and without going into all the details that I've heard from a number of people up there. Let's just say that EAA is going to be taking a different direction from what it was. And right now, the man that the EAA board has chosen to be the chairman and kind of lead the new direction, whether it is as the permanent boss or in the process of finding a replacement for Hightower, is going to be Cessna's former CEO, Jack Pelton. Who's well known to folks, you know, up there at AirVenture, and so I think that's going to be quite a good choice, and we'll have to watch that kind of closely and see what happens.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob, one question. What's Jack going to bring to EAA? I mean, it seems I don't equate Cessna with Experimental Aircraft Association.
Well, of course, he's not you know, the CEO of Cessna anymore, but he has a great depth of knowledge of small airplanes. In fact, he comes from a family of small airplane pilots, and so he kind of has that in his roots. And the jet side was sort of something he got involved in as a businessman. But they're also hoping that with all of Jack's contacts and the fact that he's a smart guy. And he's a very easygoing guy. He's well liked in the industry. That he's going to bring some help, kind of foster change there at EAA that seems to have been badly needed. And again, whether it's him personally or someone he helped select that's going to take over, again, I think it's probably a good sign for EAA.
All right. Before we move on to our guest, we have a little message here from Rob.
Ah, 1978. I remember it well. It was a year, well, before I was 30. I still had my big Mustang. But one thing I really remember about 1978, that's the year I joined the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, AOPA. And now I'd like to give you that same recommendation. Join AOPA with the new Center to Advance the Pilot Community, and of course, AOPA Pilot Magazine, a great publication that's probably worth the money just alone, and thousands of other resources available online. AOPA membership is the best $45 you'll ever spend. Join now. Visit AOPA.org/membership and tell them Rob from the Airplane Geek sent you. You'll be glad you did. And remember, you don't need to be a pilot to join AOPA.
Again, our guest this episode is Dan Hampton, author of Viper Pilot, a memoir of air combat. So, Dan, thanks again for coming on the show.
Oh, no worries. Thanks for the invite.
Now, Dan, I'm an engine guy, And so, you know, we tend to kind of think that jets like F-16s, you know, the real thing that counts is the engine, and the rest of it is sort of the life support system around the engine. It's all about the engine. Now, as a pilot, you probably have a little different perspective, but
you think?
Tell us about the kick in the pants that a fighter like the F-16 gives. Is there any way that you can relate that to something that we'd be able to relate to in the real world?
Everybody asks that, you know, and the tough thing, as you guys know, in describing aviation is unless somebody's a pilot, you know, or has a lot of experience with airplanes, there's really nothing in everyday life that equates to it, you know what I mean? You know, somebody asked me, well, is it anything like the computer game? And after I threw up, I laughed a little bit, or, you know, is it like a roller coaster? And as you very well know, there's really nothing like it. I mean, the F-16, the GE engine, since you're an engine guy, that I was most fond of in the Block 50, put out 50,000, if you equate it to horsepower, it's 50,000 horsepower, okay? How do you describe the kick in the pants of 50,000 horses hurtling you down the runway or up into space? I mean, you really can't, can you?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything like it. I can't even imagine. Maybe someday I'll have a chance to experience maybe even something close to it. But
well, I wish I had had the chance to take you up and make you sick when I was
yeah, I'd gladly go up and
oh, I would. I'd kill for that.
Did you ever launch off a carrier?
Are you kidding me? You haven't seen my picture, but I don't think I look stupid, do I?
Oh.
Actually, my father, who was a Marine fighter pilot, and my grandfather, too, who was also in the Marines, all, you know, they both said, look, if all you want to do is fly airplanes, join the Air Force. There's nothing wrong with Marine fighter pilots. I've fought them my whole career. They're good guys. But, you know, it's kind of an ancillary mission to what the Marine Corps does, right? They, you know, they storm beaches and charge up hills. In the Air Force, the whole thrust of the Air Force is about flying, so I think it's a better environment for pilots. So, no, I never landed on the carrier.
I wondered, because when the guys were talking about not being able to relate to that kick, I mean, I was just watching something on one of the channels, and they talked about going from 0 to 100 and, I don't know, 175 knots in 2 seconds or something like that in afterburners. So I'm sure that's got to be pretty exciting.
Well, yeah, and, you know, in the book that I'm sure all of you have read by now, there's a chapter on Egypt when I was over there as an exchange pilot, and I did all the test flights over there. So you get to fly what's called a clean F-16, which means there's no tanks, there's no weapons, there's nothing hanging on the wings, and you can basically go as fast and pull as hard as you want, which is kind of the idea behind a test flight, you know, to make sure everything's put back together right. And in a clean F-16, you know, I actually had to pull the throttle back out of afterburner by the end of the runway to keep from going supersonic. You know, I think I went from the surface to 20,000 feet in maybe 25, 30 seconds, something like that. So, yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. It's like riding a rocket.
Dan, do you want to impart the rest of that story? Because that was my top choice of the one I wanted you to tell tonight. I wanted to hear that one in your own words.
I want people to buy the book and read it for themselves. What do you want to know? Seriously, what do you want to know?
No, I want to know what it's like to dead stick an F-16 back into an Egyptian airfield.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't recommend it unless you absolutely have to. And I, you know, like I wrote, I absolutely have to. I think the whole flight lasted, what, a minute or something like that? That it wasn't very long. Fortunately, when the engine decided to take a nap, I had 500 and something miles an hour, you know, at the end of the runway, and was already pointed straight up. So only a moron fighter pilot, which there aren't any, couldn't land an F-16 on a 2 mile long runway, you know, with 500 knots to spare. So I just kind of did a big loop over the top. My biggest concern at that point, there were two actually, was I going to catch on fire and burn up? Because every indication I had in the cockpit was that I was on fire. And then the second thing was actually ejecting out of an F-16 maintained by the Egyptians, which didn't really thrill me because I didn't have a lot of confidence in their midst of our ejection seat. Yeah, fortunately, it worked out all right. Like I wrote about, you know, I didn't have one of the gear come down, so it was just, you know, more pain on top of it, and I managed to land, and as I was sitting there, that peasant with the donkey walked in front of me. I couldn't believe it, because on a U.S. airbase anywhere in the world, I mean, you don't get anywhere near the flight line without being shot unless you have, you know, the proper ID, and here's this peasant wandering around there with a donkey. It was an interesting morning.
You know, Dan, one of the things I wondered as I was reading that story about that little adventure of yours is there must be problems that come up from time to time when you're flying one of these things. And what, you know, what's the trade-off between, you know, punching out and making sure you're safe and wanting to save the aircraft?
Well, that's a real good question. And I think it comes down, if you're talking about emergencies, like I mentioned, you know, there's two kinds, the kind that will kill you and the kind that won't. The kind that won't, you can afford to take your time with and, you know, do what you need to do. The kind that will kill you, you know, then it comes down to an easy choice. Can I put this airplane down on the ground somewhere and save the airplane and not kill anybody underneath me, or not? And if the answer is not, then, okay, what do I have to do to get to this airplane to the point where I can bail out of it and it's not going to kill anybody on the ground? I had a real good friend who lost an engine in Florida a while back, and he did everything right. He did everything he could, and in the end, he had to jump out of it, and he went 1,000 feet below the minimum ejection altitude to try to avoid a neighborhood. And in the end, there wasn't anything he could do other than be in the airplane when it crashed or not, so he had to eject. That's the mentality I think most fighter guys have. There was a guy who jet stick one into Chicago.
Yes.
Yeah, it's probably been 20 years, but I mean, he didn't bail out on purpose because he was over Chicago. And, you know, an F-16 coming down in Chicago would make what kind of a mess?
Well, Dan, let me ask you about Iraq. I mean, you were sort of at the pointy end of the spear for both of the wars in Iraq. Well, the first time you were, I guess that was your first, was that your first combat mission?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and for the second war, you had quite a bit of experience under your belt by that point. But, you know, as a pilot, what were you thinking for the first Iraqi war, and what were you thinking for the second as you were, you know, kind of preparing for your mission?
Well, for the first one, I was very young and very excited because, you know, to a young man, there's probably no greater challenge than combat. So I wasn't smart enough to realize all the ramifications of it.
Yeah.
So I was pretty excited and happy to be there. I was more worried about screwing something up than I was about anything else. You know, you guys are around airplanes and pilots, so I'm sure you get that. By the time the second war rolled around, you know, I wasn't a lieutenant anymore. I was a lieutenant colonel, and other people's lives were in my hands, and I had a much greater awareness of what was going on around me and what could go wrong than I had the first time. So I was more concerned with getting the overall mission done and keeping everybody alive versus the first time when I just didn't want to screw up. Does that make sense?
Go ahead, David.
Oh no, I was gonna dovetail on that first mission in Desert Storm. I thought it was amazing that the first time you ever fired a HARM missile was in combat. I know they're expensive and they're large and they don't get rid of them quickly, but what was that like leaving the airplane for the first time? Did it sort of surprise you? Was it like you trained for or?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't really like anything in training because, as you said, I'd never shot one in practice. You know, I'd gone through all the motions right up until the point where the thing comes off the rail, but we'd never actually carried them live. And, you know, and the HARM missile, turns out, you know, takes about a half a second to get off the rail, and there's an enormous cloud of smoke and vapor that comes with it. So, you know, everybody you're shooting at now knows exactly where you are. That's one of those lessons, you know, you learn the hard way. There's really no way to train for it. I'm not a big HARM fan anyway. You know, we carried them probably for maybe a third of the missions I flew in the first war, I think I only carried them one time in the second war, because we were much more into destruction than we were into just, you know, making somebody blink and suppression, which is all the harm's really good for anyway.
Yeah, I was sort of surprised that you took that attitude, and then you much preferred having a cluster bomb or a bunch of cluster bombs hanging underneath your aircraft to do wider devastation than just the anti-radiate or the SEED mission.
Yeah, you know, and don't take it the wrong way. I mean, SEED suppression is necessary, but what I and a lot of guys like me came to the, you know, we all came to the same conclusion, was that you use suppression in order to destroy the SAM. You don't use it as a you know, a means to an end, because if you just suppress it, you know, it's like stepping on a bully's toes instead of putting him in the hospital. If you step on his toes, he's going to be pissed off and ready for you the next day at school. But it's the same thing with a SAM. You shoot a harm at it, you know, who knows where it's going to go to begin with. And number two, you know, it was never designed, and I'm not really slamming the harm, because it was never designed to destroy anything. It was simply designed to suppress. Well, okay, that's okay, but it leaves you with a threat to deal with the next day, or the next week, or the next war, in our case. So I was more of the opinion that if I'm there in the right place at the right time and I can see this thing, that I'd much rather kill it so I don't have to worry about it, or somebody else doesn't have to worry about it next time around.
Can I jump in here as well? This is Steve Trumbull, and I apologize for all my technical difficulties.
Glad to have you back.
Yeah, I'm back. And that what you're talking about there, I was just curious if you've looked at what they're doing now with AARGM, and I think even HDAM, the new harm, the upgraded harm system. What do you think about those upgrades?
Well, I think it's a fine idea. It's about 20 years too late. We've been jumping up and down about this, gosh, ever since I got into weaseling, and I think it's nice that they finally decided to address some of these concerns and do something about it. Any improvement in any weapon, you know, is welcome. I am not of the mindset that there is one solution for every problem. I'd like to have a choice when I'm presented with a threat of how I deal with it. And the better the weapons are, the easier it is for me to do that. So I'm glad they're doing it.
Now, what they've also talked about doing, and they got the funding yanked last year, but maybe it'll come back, is a dual role missile, a HARM and an AMRAAM put together in the same missile, the dual role air dominance munition, or missile.
I don't really know anything about that. In principle, you know, the idea is that, all right, if there's a radar emitting, then we can have something to guide on it, and, you know, whether it's in an airplane or in an armored trailer on the ground, who knows. You know, but I'll say this, you know, like I just said, the SAM systems tend to have armor and fighter jets don't. So, you know, any kind of combination missile like that would have to take that into account. I mean, you actually have to pierce the thing and blow it up. So I'm not sure how that's solved.
That's a good point. And the real driver for it is that HARM will not fit in the internal weapons bay of F-22 or F-35.
There we get into politics now, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. So they cannot do the Wild Weasel mission without an internal weapon.
Well, and that's, you know, I know where they're coming from. It's sort of the one-size-fits-all approach. You know, it's sort of like the people that believe that, you know, manned aircraft are on their way out and that, you know, drones are going to take our place, which is, you know, obviously not accurate. Until things change drastically, I don't think you can get rid of an F-16 or something like it that carries real bombs and real munitions that can, you know, hover overhead or go down where it's nasty when there's, you know, ground people engaged. You're going to need people like us to go down there and do the dirty work. You can't do it from 40,000 feet and 15 miles away. It didn't work.
Dan, I got a question for you. You talk about when you were at Spang early in your career and you're flying the killer version of the F-16, the Block 25 with the F-4Gs. Didn't you get that kind of attitude from the Phantom guys?
Well, some of them. You know, like I said, and you know, I want to be real clear about this. I learned a lot from those guys. I mean, there were some guys, especially the EWOs, you know, the backseaters, that, I mean, they could listen to this little chirping noise in their headset and they could tell me exactly what radar it was and where it was located. I mean, some of them were amazing. I think it was Black Magic, you know. So I know I ripped on the other type sort of in my book, but I think I also gave credit to the ones that were really good and taught me a lot. Problem a lot of those guys had, if they had a problem, and some of them didn't, but was that, you know, their profession was going away as they saw it, you know, especially the backseaters. And a lot of those guys, you know, they were good guys. That was as close as they could get to it. And they weren't real thrilled about, you know, their job being taken over by electronics any more than I would be about my job being taken over by a robot. You know, so in a lot of ways, their pushback was understandable. The really, really good ones, though, knew that they could still contribute and make a difference, and they went off and they helped develop, you know, the HTS system for the F-16 and other things. You know, Spangdahlen was a strange case because it was really kind of the crossroads of two different generations. There was the Vietnam-era guys, you know, that smoke cigars in the cockpit and would, you know, fly in against anything, anywhere, anytime. And then there were guys like me that they saw as kind of like, you know, Gen Xers coming along with our Green Magic and our F-16. Kind of the same way, you know, I would feel about the next generation after me. So, you know, the short answer is, in the end, they all acted like professionals and we all did what we had to. But I think there was a lot of pushback from some of them regarding the Weasel mission. They saw it as their province, and they didn't really like the, you know, the thought of us taking it over.
You know, Dan, as I was reading your book, one of the things that occurred to me is the amount of, I don't know, I'm not a pilot, but the amount of flying that you had to do. We hear about, you know, the last manned fighter has now been built and everything, you know, will be, you know, autonomous or remotely piloted or something like that in the future. But when I read about, you know, the things that you had to do, on the spot decisions, just amazing things, it's kind of hard to imagine that being done by someone or some, you know, by someone somewhere else or by some machine in the airplane.
Yeah, you know, and I'll say this. Ever since about 1915 or 16, when one guy could be a fighter pilot and somebody else couldn't, there's always been the, you know, the wannabes and the guys that have been trying to get rid of us, and it's just never worked. In modern terms, our brains perform 36 trillion calculations per second, okay? And we've got something in the order of 3.5 terabytes of memory. You guys are geeks, so you appreciate this, you know, of a capability in our pointy heads. They haven't yet invented a supercomputer that has that capability. And until they do, I'm not too worried about, you know, some guy sitting in a trailer at Creech Airfield in Nevada taking my place, because it's not going to happen. Okay? It's just not going to happen.
So speaking of new pilots, one of the things I want to ask you, you know, for our younger listeners, and we have quite a number of them, is how do you know if you'd make a good military pilot or, you know, even a fighter pilot?
Yeah, that's a superb question. And if I had the answer, I'd open up a consulting business and charge people for my solution. Yeah. I'll tell you this. You know, the Air Force, the military, not just the Air Force, but the military does a really good job, I think, of screening people before they ever get the chance to step into a military trainer. A lot of it is academics. A lot of it is your just basic physical and coordination abilities and things like that. They do a pretty good job with that. You know, it's like asking a, you know, I'm not a surgeon or an Olympic athlete, but, you know, if you ask those guys, what does it take? I think they give the same answer, was it's just something that you're born with and that you know that you can do. I know that's an ambiguous answer, but, you know, I never had any doubt once I got into that environment that I could do this, because I'm not going to say it was easy, but it was comfortable, if that makes sense. I you know, I could multitask. I could do 10 things at once. I didn't get focused on one thing and almost fly into the ground. A lot of that kind of thing, you don't really, it's not really revealed until you're actually doing it. you know, but they've perfected, I think, the screening programs to the point where they can get a pretty good gauge of somebody before they, you know, spend millions of dollars trying to train them how to do this.
And it seemed like you really enjoyed the training. I mean, the training is intense. That's another thing I found fairly interesting was just the. I mean, I always knew there'd be a lot of training, but there's a lot of training, and I got the sense that, you know, you kind of liked that.
Well, you know, we're all taxpayers, right? So you're not going to turn a $50 or $100 million fighter over to some bozo that buzzes control towers, are you?
No, not.
I don't want to do that. So, yeah, you know, I actually did enjoy it. I was always kind of a slow starter. Maybe not slow, but I was a cautious starter. You know, I would feel the program out, whatever it was, and I would try to figure it out to the extent I could, and then I would kind of shine through towards, you know, the middle or the end. Turns out that's kind of the best way to do it. I knew a lot of guys that did really, really well at the beginning of different programs, and then they kind of finished back in the back. The thing about military training is a lot of it is fairly predictable. They tell you right up front what's expected of you, and then they sit back and they watch to see whether you can live up to it or not. A lot of it is unpredictable, too, but, you know, I enjoyed it. To be honest, I didn't have anything else to do with my life at the time. I'd gotten a degree in architecture, but I didn't really want to practice architecture. And I couldn't think of anything better than flying a jet fighter. And so I devoted everything I had to it. So, yeah, I enjoyed it.
What do you think differentiates, U.S. fighter pilots from those in other countries? Do you think we're the best? And if so, who's second best?
Yes, we are the best. That's for several reasons. Obviously, technology, you know, plays a big part in it, but all things being equal, meaning everybody's in technically similar airplanes, it's going to come down to who's flying it. And by, you know, American, when I say we're the best, I mean the American military is, but there are other militaries in Europe and basically the Western Hemisphere that think like we do, have the same, you know, they grow up with the same technology and equipment, and they're very good too. And by that, I mean the Canadians, you know, the Australians, the Brits, people like that. All things being equal, though, we're the ones who come up with all those things, you know, the weapons, the airplanes, and more importantly, the training that kind of put us over the edge. Where I think Americans really shine, though, is that we are so very adaptable to situations, meaning, you know, we can throw out our playbooks if we have to, and we can improvise, and we always win when we're allowed to do that. A lot of other countries, especially those that were, you know, trained and supplied by the old Soviet Union, you know, they have more of a cookbook checklist approach to things because of, you know, who they're in fact dealing with. And that's fine, I guess, if you're on the ground, but at 500 miles an hour, you can't really, you know, be reading a checklist and, you know, going down a laundry list of items you want to do. You know, if I had to say who was second best, and by second, you mean a threat, right? You don't mean an allied air force, correct?
No, I mean really in general, any air force, ally or otherwise.
Well, you know, like I said, I kind of put the people that fly our equipment and come from our part of the world kind of all there together. And by that, I mean the Australians, the Canadians, the British, you know, a couple of the other air forces in Europe, like the Belgians, they're very good. The Dutch, they all are capable of independent thought and grow up with technology and you know, I'm not going to say in an American fashion, but they grow up in a lot of ways thinking like, you know, we all think the same versus someone that's so culturally different, like a Russian or a Chinaman, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think you gave an example in the book about, and I think it was the Iraqis that are not good at, or not trained anyway, for local decision-making, distributed decision-making. So if you cut them off from the command center, they're kind of lost and sort of could become inert, whereas...
That's very true. One thing to remember, though, and I think I made this point with the Egyptians, is that's true for, say, 48 out of 50 of them, but there's always exceptions. And, you know, it would be just your luck to run up against one of the exceptions. You know, I very rarely ever make sweeping, all-encompassing generalizations because I've seen too many, you know, exceptions to the rule. But by and large, that's a safe thing to say.
Well, I guess, Dan, my question is, quite often I heard in the book, you sort of just sort of trail off, excuse the pun, about your little friend or the ANALE-50. How many times do you think you owe your life to that little product?
Oh, man, there's really no way to give a qualitative answer to that.
Can you tell us what that thing is?
Well, it's a decoy that is manufactured by Raytheon, I think, still. And the pilot can stream it out behind the aircraft, and it, like I said, it acts as a decoy. It generates signals that hopefully attract missiles to it and not the airplane. And, you know, I've had more of those things shot off than I can remember. So, you know, theoretically, every time one of them gets shot off, you know, maybe it saved my life or at least caused the missile to miss by enough of a distance so it detonated far enough away from me where it didn't, you know, it didn't hurt the airplane.
Yeah, but how far behind the aircraft is that traveling?
A couple hundred feet.
So I imagine if a missile hit that, you pretty well can feel it up front, huh?
No, actually not, because if you think about it, you're going one way, the decoy is behind you, and the missile could be coming from any direction, so the direction of the blast is more than likely directed away from you, and it's a couple hundred feet behind you, so you know you're not going to feel it. And besides, if you're to the point where you're putting a decoy out, you're reacting pretty heavily, and you know you don't, you're not going to have a lot of time to sit there and stare behind you and see if something's been hit. You know,
yeah,
you look up in your HUD and realize, hey, the decoy's gone. You put out another one.
Interesting.
Yeah, those things are great. I wish we'd had them. I wish the guys in Vietnam had had them.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Dan, we're at the Airplane Geeks here are sort of big supporters of women in aviation. And there are some women combat pilots, but I guess not very many. Where do you think that's headed? Do you think that women can do the same job, and are they being accepted? Where do we stand on that?
Well, I think it's a generational thing now more than anything. You know, the guys 30 years ago would never have, I mean, they would have fought it tooth and nail. Hell, they fought against, you know, my generation tooth and nail because they thought we were a bunch of, you know, techie geeks. You know, I think that the present generation is a lot more accepting of changes than they were. Mine was kind of in the middle. I never went to war with a girl. I don't know why a woman would want to do it. Can they do it? Yeah, they can do it. I mean, you know, there were a couple of female aces in World War II. You know, they can physically do it, and I think all of us have probably run across some women in our lives that are, you know, bigger and stronger than some men. And not that I would date. You might, but not me. Gotcha. Anyway, you know, here's my only issue with that, and it's the same with anything. I don't care whether somebody in the next cockpit is black, white, red, yellow, green, a Martian, you know, a female, a guy, brunette, blonde. I don't care, as long as they went through everything I went through and they can do everything I can do, and they're not going to get me killed because somebody decided to fill a quota.
Yeah.
Okay? Hmm. So, to me, you know, being a fighter pilot was one of the last merit-based, you know, fields open. I mean, you know, you got the SEALs and the Special Forces and guys like that. And that's fine. And, you know, I think most guys in a position like this would agree, as long as the person next to me or in the next airplane can do everything I can do, then I don't care what they are. Okay?
Sure.
If that's an answer.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, one of the things when I was reading the book, you know, there's a lot of traditions and I won't call it hazing, really, but, you know, kind of activities that, you know, the guys engage in. And that's part of the culture, I think, of you know, being a fighter pilot. And you know, some of those things I don't think a lot of women would be really, you know, wanting to engage in that kind of stuff. So does that mean that, you know, those kinds of things are going to change or fall away? Or are women just going to get involved in those same kinds of, you know, fun and games sorts of activities?
No, I think the profession makes the person, not the other way around. So I think somebody, a woman that really wanted to be a fighter pilot would be in favor of all the traditions and aspects of it that go with it. You know, and she should go into it with her eyes open, realizing that, hey, you know, this is the profession I've chosen. I can't remake it to suit my personal inclinations. You know, I knew a lot of guys that, you know, they were good fighter pilots, but they were a lot more, you know, a lot of them were married and had families and didn't engage in a lot of that stuff. And that was a personal choice. And they just, you know, they would leave. They would, you know, they'd go somewhere else, and that's fine. Nobody tried to force them to. And then again, they didn't try to force their views on any of us. And, you know, we didn't invent that. That goes all the way back to 1914, 1915. So, you know, it predates any of our prejudices. So I would say that if anybody, male or female or whatever, wants to get into this profession, then they need to realize that's a part of it.
Now, on the book, I found your book on Amazon.com. In fact, I downloaded the Kindle version, which I read on my iPad. Is that kind of the best place for folks to go to find the book? Are there other places that people can go online to find your book?
Barnes & Noble sells it online. Let's see, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I think Books A Million does too. I'm not sure, but I know Barnes & Noble does. And HarperCollins tells me to say this: if you guys buy it and you like it, then by all means, please do a favorable review. That's always appreciated.
Ah, sure.
So the Kindle version, is that the expanded ebook?
I don't know. I guess.
Because, you know, I'm not an ebook kind of guy. I like to hold a book and, you know, turn pages. And I'd never actually seen one until they made one of Viper Pilot, and they did a superb job with it. I mean, there's video clips in there. They did a cockpit, an expanded cockpit view where, you know, if you come across heads-up display or pickle button in the book, I think it's in a different font, and you can click on it, and it shows you a picture of what it looks like. They really did a good job on that. So anybody that's into the ebook, I would encourage them to have a look at that, too.
All right, fantastic.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Dan, do you miss flying fighters?
Yeah, I do. I mean,
what do you miss about it?
You know, there's nothing, even though I still do, you know, other work and it's exciting and I get an adrenaline rush and all that stuff, you know, there's just nothing like plugging in an afterburner, you know, as the sun comes up and you rock it off, you know, into the morning, and you look around and, you know, for 2 seconds you have to think about it. You think, boy, this is really cool. You know, there's nothing like that. But, you know, I had had enough of the bureaucracy. I'd had enough of the, you know, I think anybody in any organization kind of gets fed up sometimes with the bureaucratic end of things. And I knew that, you know, past lieutenant colonel, you know, the opportunities of flying are pretty scarce. And even the guys that do fly, you know, they'll never be one of the boys again, because as a colonel, you're kind of in a different, you know, you're a different entity. You
get treated essentially, right?
You know, most of your friends retire or get out, and, you know, it just isn't the same. So I wanted to go out while I was more or less on top, you know what I mean? And I didn't want to make coffee in the Pentagon either.
Are you still flying?
Yeah, I still fly. I have a private military company of my own, and some of what we do is aviation-based, so I still get to do it.
Is that something that you want to plug?
No, it's not that kind of a business, if
okay.
You get my drift.
Sure.
I will plug the next book I wrote, though, which is, it's actually due in 2 weeks to HarperCollins and comes out in March, I think. It's called The Mercenary.
Oh, no kidding. I wasn't aware that you had a second book coming. I mean, this book here that we're talking about, Viper Pilot, is just out.
Well, I think that's why they want this other one finished. They're going to put it out in ebook format first, just so they can get it out. And then I've got another nonfiction book that's flying related that's due to them sometime next year and should come out in 2014.
Wow. Yeah, your writing style is, I find it really engaging, because it's, you know, it's, I don't know, it just seems real and honest. It's, I mean, you know, the imagery is good. You feel like you're there, but you also feel like you're, you know, reading something or listening to someone who really knows what's going on from the inside. So it's got that sort of honest quality to it, which I really like.
Well, thanks. That's a very nice compliment. I tried to write it without any BS, you know. Too many times I think people write the way they expect, you know, what they think it should sound like. And I wrote it the way that I saw it, the way I heard it, the way I smelled it sometimes. Because when I read books, that's what I want. You know, that's what I like to hear and see. You know, I like to feel like I'm there. You know what I mean?
Sure. And the there, in this case, the places you've been are just amazing. So it's a fantastic read.
Yeah, well, thanks. It was an interesting life.
Yes, quite. Quite. All right. Well, so, Dan. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, Dan, before we sign off, I do want to say thank you for your service. Because I won't spoil it for the book, but I was really surprised when I found out what incident you were part of and survived. But thank you for your service. And when the next book comes out, will you come back on?
I would love to. And thank you for thanking me. There were a lot of other guys besides me, though. But it's nice to hear it. And I would be happy to come back. And I will tell HarperCollins that I didn't make too bad of a mess of things, and you guys want me to come back. Thanks.
Outstanding. So, Dan Hampton, author of Viper Pilot, a memoir of air combat. Thanks again.
Thank you, guys.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 22nd of October, 2012.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode number 220. Well, you know, folks, many of you would know that I drive trains for a living, and I can tell you what, I see some really strange things at railway stations at times. But I tell you what, Grant, if you'd been up at the Maryborough Railway Station here in central Victoria last weekend, you would have seen something attached to that station that was a little bit weird. Can you shed any light on that, Grant McHaren?
It wouldn't have been a hot air balloon inflated on the grass in front of the station, would it?
Those balloon pilots, they will attach those things to anything.
It was actually tied to the bull bar of a four-wheel drive parked on the grass.
Well, there you go. Now, that's a classic-looking railway station, mate. And I, up there in central Victoria on the glorious weekend we just had, that would have been rather spectacular. Were you flying it by any chance?
I was the pilot in command of the tether, yes.
Awesomeness.
There are some rather good photos that one of our guys took that I'll have to post once I get the originals to me. It does look rather spectacular against the backdrop of that classic, beautiful old, I guess it's Edwardian architecture on the train station there at Maryborough. It's a beautiful old classic building, that one.
Now, you know, Grant, that's near a high-speed railway line. I don't actually drive on that line, but they do about 100 miles an hour down that track sometimes. Perhaps you should have, you know, if you wanted some excitement, you could always attach your balloon to said train.
Yeah, that would be very interesting for at least 30 seconds. Then it would just be very painful.
Yeah, I must write that into the courseware that I'm teaching my latest bunch of students, how to cope with rampant balloon pilots.
Now, is it safe to ask how you knew about this, Steve?
Probably from your constant bragging on Facebook, mate.
Yeah, well, there is that.
I tell you what, Grant, if you're up there in central Victoria, you would get a pretty good view of a lot of native wildlife jumping around, particularly kangaroos. You didn't scare one down to Melbourne Airport on your way back, did you?
Not that I recall. I did see a few individuals and a reasonably large mob of them hopping through somebody's field at one point while I was out flying on the Saturday.
Well, it looks like one of them was looking for some rather expensive parking in the Melbourne Airport multi-story car park. I don't know how he could afford to be up there, but he was, according to this article here in the heraldsun.com.au.
Oh, maybe he had a few spare notes or a good credit card in his pouch.
Absolutely. Now, Rob, I know Rob's always picking on us for destroying our native wildlife and eating it, but I did shoot this one, but fear not, Rob, only with a tranquilizer dart.
Oh, okay. Trying to keep it fresh for the pot later, huh?
Absolutely. I reckon it'd be delicious.
So did they say where the roo came from, or is it just one that's hopped in from the bushland in the area?
I'd say it would, and of course, for people who are not familiar with the Melbourne area, of course, Melbourne Airport is up on the northwest and outskirts of the city, and it's not uncommon to see kangaroos jumping around there, although they normally don't make it into the car park, and that's a very busy car park up there at the Melbourne Airport, so I'm sure that poor kangaroo would have been scared half to death, especially when he saw the bill for parking.
Well, yeah, I think that's the biggest problem he had. Maybe he was there trying to get some good views of the aircraft.
Yeah, well, he should have hopped his way down to Avalon. Looks like there'll be plenty of open space there pretty soon.
Well, mate, I don't know if they're going to knock down those hangars, but definitely Qantas have twisted the knife yet again in on the Avalon maintenance base that they've got there. Any hope that they may have been trying to hold it on and keep it going and spin out the jobs there for a bit longer have been kind of shot down with the news that they've invested $30 million in their heavy maintenance base up in Queensland and Brisbane, about 2,000 kilometres to the north.
Absolutely, Grant. And of course, this is really not new news. I mean, we know the Qantas has been out there talking about, well, you know, we may close Avalon, but I don't think anyone's now in any doubt. According to this article here in AustralianAviation.com.au, Qantas Chief Alan Joyce says, we've already started on a process to consolidate our heavy maintenance facilities from three sites to now two sites to ultimately one in Australia. He said he set no time frame, but it's something that needs to happen. Well, I guess, you know, the maintenance facility that's been built up there at Brisbane is state of the art, of course, according to all reports. So I guess the rather antiquated facilities down here, they're not long for the world. And of course, they mainly service 747s down there, and Qantas only have nine of those left. So I guess the way things are going with the attrition rate of those aircraft, and Qantas 747s are quite old now, I'd say it's only a matter of time.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame that they're going to wind it up. It's going to be rather odd going past that area and not seeing a few red tails hanging out.
Well, of course, it follows on from what we were talking about last week, Grant, where there was some positive news there for Avalon. So let's hope that as one chapter closes there at Avalon, that they do go ahead and build that international airport upgrade that we were talking about last week. And I guess in some way that'll compensate for the loss of that facility there.
True, mate, true. But, you know, continuing on and speaking of bad news, up in Brisbane, there's a bit of a court case going on against Flight Centre. Flight Centre is one of the biggest ticketing groups here, lots of offices all around Australia where you can go in and plan your holidays and set up your flights and do all sorts of things like that. Well, the ACCC is taking them to task for trying to set up collusion and price fixing. Apparently, Flight Centre were talking to three airlines, specifically Singapore, Malaysian and Emirates, asking them to stop selling their international airfares directly to customers, including over the internet, at prices for less than what Flight Centre offered, because it was actually hurting Flight Centre's profit margins, because Flight Centre have a stated agreement on their website which says if you can find it cheaper, including on the airline's webpage, we have to beat that fare by at least $1. Otherwise, they have to give the customer a $20 voucher and forfeit their commission. So, of course, as the airlines were dropping their prices, Flight Centre were losing their commissions or seeing their profits disappear, and asked the airlines for no discounts. And in fact, when Singapore Airlines said they wouldn't take part, Flight Centre sent an email to all their staff saying, turn the screw on Singapore Airlines because they don't value you and don't sell their tickets anymore.
Yeah, Singapore Airlines, well, they won't be happy about that. And I guess they are trying to make the case there that it's anti-competitive, hence they're going off to the ACCC to see what they can do about that.
It's an interesting situation. Of course, Flight Centre's been in the news a lot this year for making great profits and stepping ahead leaps and bounds and so on. And I think now we're starting to see how they manage that.
I think you're absolutely right, Grant. And I tell you what, talking of people that are good at managing things, the New South Wales Police Force, they're usually good at managing public order. But I tell you what, they've got some muscled up guys there. They're pretty good at managing dragging around aircraft.
So it would appear, mate. The RAAF base Richmond had a fundraiser where they park a C-130J Hercules, obviously with park brake off, and get teams of people to try and tow it over a 10-metre distance. Whichever team does it in the fastest time gets to win the prize, and the proceeds all go to charity, of course. And in this case, although the RAF-based Richmond team got the fastest time during trials, it turns out that the Public Order and Riot Squad of the New South Wales Police, for the third year running, won it with a time of 12.42 seconds. I'd say the lesson here is don't mess with the New South Wales Riot Squad, even if you do bring your own Hercules.
Yeah. I think what it was, Grant, actually, is that they bought their own support team who basically put all the RAF Richmond team, you know, under arrest and threatened them with all sorts of things. They're pretty beefy-looking coppers there. I don't think, yeah, if you want to take this, Herc, it's all yours, boys.
Yeah, no fuel, though, so you got
to
tow it.
Well, Grant, let's cross briefly across the Tasman to the Shaky Isles, and the New Zealand Defence Force have picked themselves up four shiny new King Airs from Hawker Pacific.
Well, that's a pretty good move for Hawker Pacific, and not too bad for the Kiwis. They seem to have been taking a few lessons from the RAF, who have a few King Airs that they use for training as well as carrying people around the country. And that's exactly what the Kiwis will be doing with them. They'll be using them for advanced pilot training and a domestic air transport capability for the next 5 years.
According to a quote here by the Chief of Air Force, Air Vice Marshal Peter Stockwell, the B-200 aircraft is a critical component of our fleet as it will be our interim advanced pilot training aircraft and also provide a domestic air transport capability. If it's only an interim aircraft, Grant, I wonder what they're going to order next. Maybe some F-16s.
Oh, well, you know, they were going to get some of them ages ago, weren't they? Before, just about the time they were officially retiring the A-4s.
Oh, boy, I tell you what, I'm going to get some hate mail for that, Grant. Well, speaking of mail, I should have a bit of a mea culpa before we go, Grant. It seems in the words of Fonzie...
I was risen.
Yes.
I was risen. I was not exactly right.
Ah, yes, the Fonzie. Okay, mea culpa. I was wrong, Grant. You fess up on my behalf, or shall I do it?
Yeah, the A330 hasn't been delivered. They're just rolling out the paint scheme.
Oh, well. Well, it was close.
Yeah, sorry. Steve was editing and thought he could get away with it in the early hours of the morning. No one will notice the fact that Fiji Air haven't really had their new aircraft delivered. It's just that they've rolled out the colour schemes that the new aircraft will have. Oh, no. Thank you, Stephen Dornblum. Spotted it and called the ball.
Yes. Oh, well, you know what we should do, Grant? We should hold that article over and we'll play it again next year when they do get those aircraft delivered.
Yeah, that'll save us a bit of time, won't it?
Save me a bit of editing, absolutely. So there you go, and I'm sure Max will play that voicemail a bit later on in the show. Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. Peter Johnson's up next across the pond with the final of his four-part series there at the Royal Naval Historic Flight.
We were granted behind-the-scenes access to the Royal Navy Heritage Flight. In this segment, we get to talk about flying.
Back in the hangar with Lieutenant Commander Glenn Allison, who's the commanding officer of 727 Naval Air Squadron. But we're here today not to talk about your day job, but to talk about what it's like to fly the Swordfish. And we're in front of the aircraft now. You've just come back on a sortie in the Chipmunk. Can you just explain why you need to do that?
Yeah, we train our pilots on the Chipmunk. Yeah. It's a tail dragger aircraft, unlike most of the modern aircraft that we've all trained on during our naval careers.
Yeah.
I'm a helicopter pilot. We train on fixed wing, you know, with a nose wheel, whereas back in the 30s and 40s, everyone trained on tail dragger, so it became second nature to them. So the Chipmunk's very useful for us to conduct that tail wheel training, and then we'll step up from that into bigger, heavier aircraft, and then onto the Swordfish itself.
Yeah, okay, and she's a big aircraft. And the transition between the Chipmunk and the Swordfish is quite a step up. What's she like to fly?
It's actually remarkably straightforward.
Yeah.
Going from the Chipmunk to the Swordfish. We do have another aircraft which helps us to get used to the braking system in the Swordfish, which is a Percival Provost.
Okay.
Which is owned by one of the trustees, and that prepares you for the pneumatic brakes that we've got in the Swordfish. But taxiing the Swordfish is fairly straightforward. It's got such a big wing area. It's quite easy in a crosswind for the wings to lift.
Yeah.
And you've got automatic slats,
which
are aerodynamically operated. So you can get a lot of lift off a wing as you're turning crosswind.
Yeah.
So it's important to have all the techniques ingrained into you about, you know, using interwind aileron, stick back using the slipstream for steering. But once you get the aircraft airborne, on the takeoff, it's very easy to keep straight. It's got a really big fin.
Yeah.
Lots of authority on the rudder. And we're generally operating it off big, long runways.
Yeah.
So we've got 7,000 foot runway here. And it's, you know, the speeds are fairly similar to the Chipmunk. So it takes off at 60 knots, climbs at 70, cruises around at 90 knots. I'd say the most difficult part of it is affecting a very nice landing.
Right, okay. Because we're all watching.
Because it's got a, you know, it's designed to land on aircraft carriers. It's got a very springy undercarriage.
Right, okay.
As I mentioned, it's got a big wing area and automatic slats, which can come out asymmetrically.
Yeah, okay.
So we tend to wheeler the aircraft on to protect the tail wheel. So tail down wheeler type landings. And to be honest, as per the Chipmunk, it's pretty good up to a, up to a 50 knot crosswind, which is the limit we've been given. So
wow, that's quite high.
And, you know, we wouldn't consider landing it anything less than sort of 2,500 foot of runway. So,
right.
We don't want to be standing on the brakes or that sort of thing.
And but it's a traditional cockpit. It's the original cockpit.
Yeah, it's all original.
In terms of the equipment that you have to navigate around the country and that sort of thing, obviously you carry an observer. when you're on displays?
We can operate the aircraft with a pilot and a rear crew member. So it can be an observer, it can be a modern-day tag, which is an air crewman, or it can be one of our maintainers.
Right, okay.
So we sometimes take the maintainers because we'll need to do the servicing and turnarounds at our landing location. The reason we have someone in the back is because we have an engine-driven fuel pump, and if the fuel pump fails, we have to transfer fuel from the main 155-gallon tank into the gravity tank.
Okay.
That can be done from the cockpit, but it'd be easier to do it from the rear cockpit.
Yeah.
So you've got to pump away on this.
It's a hand pump,
Wow. Yeah, and pump the fuel. So you get an indication that the engine-driven fuel pump's failed by a light in the cockpit, which you may not see on a sunny day.
Right.
But we regularly check the gravity tank, which has got about 20 minutes of fuel in it. So if you see the level going down on that, you need to either
to
land
pumping.
Or get pumping.
Okay.
So that's the reason we carry a rear crew
member. All right, interesting. And what's flying in the open cockpit like? I mean, Dad always said it was freezing, it was uncomfortable, but what's it like?
I imagine it could be absolutely freezing. It's ergonomically, you've got to think about what you're doing a little bit more than the normal enclosed cockpits that we're used to. And to be honest, I'd never flown in an open top or an open cockpit aircraft
until
before
this
before the Swordfish. So you just got to have yourself sorted with, you know, straps, visor. Occasionally you might get oil, you know, coming into out of the engine. So you need to make sure you've got goggles or a visor. We've got to fly with a military flying helmet. So, and maps as well. So you need to make sure if you are flying with ground crew in the back, you need to make sure you've got a spare map in your pocket.
Right.
In case you lose your map out, you know, over the side.
And is navigation VFR?
Navigation's VFR. The aircraft's cleared to go up to 10,000 feet. We tend to operate 3,000 feet and below because of headwinds and that sort of thing.
Right.
And it's all done by, you know, clock map ground.
Wow.
It'd be churlish not to carry a handheld GPS.
Yeah, sure.
And the beauty of that is it means that you can spend more time looking at the cockpit.
Yeah,
you're not
too
worried about top map ground.
Yeah,
but the important thing is to fly in a safe, you know, safe environment.
Yeah.
When we are flying, it's tend to be weekends.
Right.
And there'll be a lot of gliders, GA traffic.
Yeah.
So maintaining a good lookout is probably the most important thing. So this way, you know, having a GPS velcroed onto your knee.
Yeah.
Can just back up your visual navigation.
Okay. And what's it like to display in? I've seen it many a time. Probably seen you flying it quite a few times. Seen you flying with the Lynx.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a bit of a challenge?
Flying in formation is a bit more difficult in a biplane because if you're trying to formate on another aircraft, you've got some big blind spots.
Yeah.
Having other aircraft formate on you is a bit of responsibility because you're in charge of the timing, make sure that you arrive on time. But it's pretty much bread and butter for, you know, for us. But actually displaying the aircraft, it's really lovely to fly because you can really fly very tight display.
Yeah.
You can hear the aerodynamic slats going in and out as you approach the sort of above it in the stall. So the aircraft talks to you quite well. So you know exactly how the aircraft's performing. And you can do a very nice tight display. It's good for, you know, interacting with the public.
Yeah.
You know, when we do the fly past and we've got the white ensign up in the back, it's good to get close to the crowd, you know, on your fly past, so you can see the reaction. And when we taxi in, we always put the white ensign up in the back.
Yeah.
And we get, you know, a great response from,
absolutely,
from crowds at, you know, any air show we go to.
Right.
Know.
Well, we're very proud of the aircraft and very honoured to have had the opportunity to talk to you. So, Commander Allison, thank you very much.
No problem.
Hi, I'm talking to you from the warm confines of Flybe Embraer 195, climbing out of Southampton towards the north. We've broken through the clouds to a stunning sunrise over the east of England. I suppose that puts into context what Lieutenant Commander Glenn Allison was saying about flying the Swordfish there, VFR 3,000 feet in an open cockpit. But anyway, I hope you've enjoyed listening to the mini-series we've produced for you. We certainly enjoyed making it, but we'd love to hear what you think about the segment and what you're enjoying or what you're not enjoying. So please leave us some feedback either on our Facebook page or at the website, or email us, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Next week on the show, we're asking Tim Gresty back to talk to us about international airline hubs and the recent news about the UK lagging behind with Heathrow, pondering whether to have a third runway or not, and Boris Island being built in the Thames estuary. So we look forward to talking to Tim then.
Okay, thanks, Peter. That's the last installment of his mini-series, as he mentioned, the Royal Navy Historic Flight Series. Want to thank Peter for putting that together. It's been a real interesting listen.
Agreed. And hopefully he'll do more of those kind of series. Knowing that there's a coming attractions next week, that was really cool.
Yeah.
Nice job, Peter.
Very good. All right, time now for some Grill the Geeks questions. Guys, we have first up an audio question from Trevor.
Hi, Airplane Geeks. This is Trevor Smith with DesertPilot.com. I had a question, possibly a Grill the Geeks question. It has to do with the word mark. Where did this term come from? David, you could probably answer this, or Rob with your military background as well, but I seem to can't get a straight answer on it anywhere. And why does the military seem to name everything a mark? Case in point, on my ship, Mark 44s are chaff launchers. You would think the Mark 45 would be something similar to, you know, defense of the ship, or chaff. No, no. The Mark 45 is a 5-inch gun or cannon. So the Mark 46 is a torpedo. Okay. The Mark 47 is a grenade launcher. Okay. Now I understand military, they like to shorten everything, but is it just because we're too lazy to actually say the actual names? Why and where did the term mark come from? If you guys can answer that question, it'd be great, because I can't find the answer.
All right. Interesting question from Trevor.
Well,
a mark is like a version, right? I always thought it was like version.
It is, but the military parlance of it comes from British Navy. Guns have always been labeled as mark whatever, usually in consecutive order. Also, I mean, it's a very English thing to do, because in the United States, we call it an F-16, and usually we follow it with a suffix of like A, B, C, D. The British will call it a Spitfire Mark 1, Mark 2, Mark 3. So it's a way of determining the variant, but it's really, as far as what he was describing, I mean, it's a naval gunnery term, I mean, for the different weapon systems. And like the Mark 46 torpedo is because that was the 46th version of the torpedo. It doesn't necessarily fit in with the same as the 5-inch guns and the other stuff, unless the Navy, of course, they do change things every so often. So I would say it's just a variant, but it really does come from Navy parlance.
So it was kind of just a coincidence that so many different guns or objects or devices had mark numbers that seemed to be sort of sequential. In other words, each item's got its own sequence, and the fact that they all kind of clustered around each other was sort of a coincidence.
Yeah, well, yes and or no. My naval gunnery history left in college. I promptly forgot everything I knew about naval gunnery, but the Navy, you know, we've changed things for a while, you know, as far as aircraft designations. For a while there, we were going F-16, F-17, F-18, F-19, F-20, F-21, and then we jumped to F-22, then jumped F-35. And we went from C-130, C-141s back to C-5. So it could be that current Navy weapon systems are all given MARC designations in sequential order. I don't know that, but I would defer to anyone who's current in naval terminology.
Yeah, all right. Well, maybe that provides a little bit of information to Trevor on that subject. All right, let's do one more really quick because we're kind of running out of time. This is from Don. Don writes, name the aircraft that has flown with the most engines.
He didn't say U.S. aircraft, right?
Nope. He just says, name the aircraft that has flown with the most engines. What airplane has or aircraft has more engines than any other?
I would say the Dornier DOX or DO-10. It actually had pusher and tractor propellers and 8 engines across.
Mounted up high, right?
Up above its wing, yeah.
Up above its wing.
But 8 total, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
B-50... was the Spruce Goose? Wasn't the Spruce Goose 8 also?
Yeah, B-52s are 8.
Let's see, and the Antonov...
It could have been one of the early Antonovs, like the ANT-6, but I don't know how many... I mean, you got to talk 10 or more.
I was thinking of that Dornier also, and I mean, does each one, is that 2 engines? Are they in pairs? I mean, or is it shaft?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Off the top of my head, I don't know if it's like the HE-177 Henkel, the Grief, actually it was a 2-propellered aircraft with 2 engines linked by a transmission to 1 set of propellers, you know, and then you got aircraft that have contra-rotating propellers that are driven, I don't know. I give up.
All right. Let me open up Don's email with the answer. And let's see.
Hey, we have the envelope, please.
The envelope? Oh, boy, were we so far off. The answer? The NASA Helios. 14 solar-powered electric prop engines.
Very good. And at our favorite place to go to every June. Hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah, yeah. So
well,
good. Good one, Don.
Snapping on that one.
So that was Don from Arizona. So I think Don's going to have some airplane geeks
hardware
pins
sent to him.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, very good, Don. See, it is possible to stump us.
That's true.
You can trip us much easier, but, you know, that's something else.
All right, let's move on to listener mail really quick. I keep saying really quick. First is from Andrew. Oh, Andrew sent us a link. This is concerning a program he saw in the UK on Channel 4. It's called Plane Crash, and there's a video of the program. We'll put that link in the show notes. This is this got some publicity here in the U.S. This is where a team of folks took an old Boeing 727 and rigged it with some remote controls and I guess some instrumentation and things, and crash landed it in the Mexican desert to see.
Yeah, that was Discovery or National Geographic did that.
It was the same. Maybe it was the same program. So we'll put that link in the show notes. You can check that out if you haven't seen it. And Andy also says this is interesting. It's occurred by the time we're reading this now, but he says that he's getting a half-hour experience flight in a Tiger Moth. So that sounds really exciting. I think we need a report on that little flight, Andy. We'd look forward to that. We heard from Seekar. Seekar has written us in the past. This is an article that he sent along from Business Insider. British explorer prepares to dig up 140 mint-condition Spitfires that were buried in 1945. We don't really know what condition these things are going to come out of the ground, although they were somewhat preserved. David, do you know this story?
I do. It's a big find. And if Glacier Girl is any testament to our restoration teams around the world, I have a feeling that all of these Spitfires are going to get back in the air. If we can dig one out of a glacier and get it flying, digging them out of a ground in fairly mint condition will be a piece of cake for a lot of these guys.
Yeah, the article says they're boxed up, you know, wings back, and there's at least some of the preservation stuff has been applied. So it'll be pretty exciting to see what comes out of the ground. Let's see. We got an email from Stanislav, who says there are a lot of different kinds of amateur rallies by car. Do you know any by airplane? And I don't know. I know of one, which is the Air Race Classic. This is an air race made up of for teams made up of two or more women pilots who are flying a single or twin engine airplane. That's in June of 2013 is the next edition of that. They fly from
Powder Puff Derby, I think they call it.
Yeah, Pasco, Washington to Fayetteville, Arkansas. That one, if you're interested, the link is airraceclassic.org. I'm not aware of any other sort of rallies of that sort. Are you guys?
I can't say anything's jumping out at me. And usually the reason, I think, is that it's a safety issue.
Well, there is the rally at Oshkosh every year.
Oh, well, that's right. The bonanzas to Oshkosh.
But there's also that race that occurs on Sunday. The rally, they have an air race to Oshkosh.
Well, if maybe our listeners are aware of any others, send them along. Let us know. We can help pass that along and maybe give them some exposure. All right, a couple of voicemails from Stephen Thornbloom. The first is on 100 LOLED. Here's Stephen.
Hey, guys. It's Stephen out in California. Actually, technically, I'm in Phoenix. I'm leaving Phoenix after visiting some friends out here and driving home. Just listening to episode 218, and I got through the first news item, and I had to call you guys regarding the fuel issue with the 100 LOLED. And a funny little story, when I was younger and working at a flight school out here in California, I was in charge of, basically I was the office manager, which one of the duties was, I had to take our 1970-something old car, which had a 100-gallon fuel tank in the trunk of the car, to the local gas station to put, I believe it was 89 or 91 octane gas in it, and that is what the aircraft at the flight school ran off of. The owners of the school had discovered, at least, I don't know what the difference is technically, but that the aircraft could run off of 91 octane instead of 100 LOLED. It was cheaper for them to buy the fuel this way, and there weren't any maintenance issues as far as what I had heard of. No incidents, no safety issues ever came up. And there was about 9 aircraft at the flight school. The worst part of the whole job was driving the 2 miles from the gas station to the airport with 100 gallons in your tank, praying that nobody would rear-end you, because you can only imagine what that outcome would be. The kicker to the 100-gallon tank was that it had its own pump, just like at the gas station with a little hose. You could reach the aircraft by just pulling the car up and fuel each aircraft. So I just thought that would be a little interesting story for the article or the news story that you guys had on the 100 LOLED gas going away possibly, and having the FAA with its own little office to try to fix this issue. Anyway, that's it. I'm going to go back and listen to that episode and 219. I have 5 hours to go on the drive, so take care and talk to you soon.
Well, I guess people can be pretty resourceful at times.
Yeah.
that's wild.
It's scary. I know our flying club with that new airplane I brought back from out west a couple of weeks ago, it has a Rotax engine in it, 100 horsepower Rotax, and it really loves auto gas, except there's no auto gas at Chicago Executive, and everybody wishes there were, but somebody said, well, why don't we just go, there's a gas station right out behind the hangar where we park. And somebody said, well, just get some cans and we'll fill it up and bring them back and there we go. And I said, oh my, at least in Chicago, you don't do that. They will run you off the airport.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to be able to do that.
Yeah. I think sometimes there's tax implications associated with. I think that's sometimes the violation is you're, you know, avoiding the tax by using fuel from a different source. So you have to watch.
Well,
that.
And for us at least, with the road tax, the issue is also lead, because all the autogas has no lead.
Right.
And what we have to do when we put 100 low lead in this airplane is we have to add TCP every time we fill it up to help slow the growth of the lead deposits on the plugs. So it's just one extra step, but right now there's not much we can do about it.
All right. Well, we have one more. Stephen continued listening to the podcast and sent another voicemail. This one includes the little item that Steve and Grant mentioned. So here's Stephen again.
Hey, geeks. It's Stephen out in California again. I just got done listening to episode 119 on the drive, finishing the drive home from Phoenix. I wanted to correct one little thing that Stephen Grant said in the Australia desk regarding Fiji Airways and their 330 that has been delivered. Their Airbus 330 has not been delivered. Their first aircraft is, first Airbus is scheduled to be delivered next year, but they have unveiled the paint scheme and interior as to what it will look like. So just wanted to correct that minor thing. In regards to the Restorers guest that you had on, the husband and wife, I watched the full episode, the pilot episode on YouTube, and just wanted to say that it is a really, really, really good episode. I hope that they get picked up by somebody, because I would love to see more shows done by them like this, especially maybe a full show on the Bob Odegaard and Racer 57. That would be really neat. And just wanted to say thank you to you guys for having them on the show and putting the show link in the on the website. It was really cool. And for anybody who hasn't checked it out, I would highly recommend it. Anyway, that's it. I'm looking forward to the next episode, which I believe you guys recorded tonight. So hopefully that will be out later this week. Take care. Bye.
All right. Thank you, Stephen, for sending that in. We have some pretty sharp listeners. You can't mess up or we get called out.
We have the best listeners.
Yeah.
And we don't say it enough. Our listeners are amazing.
It's actually true. In fact, I've been seeing some other podcasters, not necessarily aviation related, bemoaning the fact that they don't seem to get much interaction from their listeners. And boy, we don't have that problem at all. I mean, between the voicemails and the emails and Facebook and Twitter, we just have a great engaged audience, and we really appreciate that. All right, we better wrap this up. This is episode 220 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank you very much for listening. We want to thank our guest, Dan Hampton, author of Viper Pilot, A Memoir to Air Combat. Go take a look at that. It's a great read. One of the better reads I've had in quite a while, actually.
And Max, I forgot to say, folks, it's a 10 tanker out of 10 tanker read. It is really good.
And we want to thank Dan also for being a good sport. We had a lot of Skype issues, and so we actually had to record that over a two-day period. So I want to thank Dan for being so accommodating with that. Also, our guest co-host, Steve Trimble, who was able to join us for a little while, and want to thank him. You can find him at The Do Line at flightglobal.com, and he's also got a Twitter address, The Do Line. As always, we want to thank our contributors, Grant and Steve and Peter. And you can find Grant and Steve at plaincrazydownunder.com. Peter's at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. Also at aviationextended.co.uk. No leading E in extended. And let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob, we'll start with you. Mr. Mark, where can folks find you?
As we record this tonight, we're coming up on the week of the NBAA convention down in Orlando. So I'll be down there on Saturday till the following Wednesday. So if anybody's by, give us a tweet on Jetwine or certainly we'll be around on jetwine.com as well. And hopefully we'll see a few folks down there. I know Steve's going to be down there.
Terrific. And David
and Van? Not Steve Vischer.
Yeah, which no. Steve?
No. Steve Trimble.
Trimble. I
mean. Oh, Steve Trimble. Yes, of course. All right. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online?
Currently, I tend to be all around Jetwine Incorporated, but you can find my own personal website at whatjustflewby.com, and I will have a more detailed review of Dan's book up probably in the next week or so. Or you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof.
Outstanding. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter and Google Plus as Max Flight, also at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. That'll contain links to the news items, all the other sites that we mentioned in this podcast. Again, this is episode 220. Look for that. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and also Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. We're also on Stitcher.com. You can stream us right to your mobile phone if you visit them. And if you'd like to send us email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We also have a listener line, which you heard several examples of this episode. Let's see, Benay Wilson has the number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Aunt Benay. Opening and closing music, as always, Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. All right, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
The Airplane Geeks podcast is sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight.
But you know one thing I couldn't figure out? I mean, with a title like Viper, where were the snakes?
You don't know the story behind that?
No.
Oh, okay, well, there's two versions of it. If you stand in front of an F-16 and you look straight down, you know, the nose of it, you know, with the intake and the pointed nose, it kind of looks like a snake, a viper, if you've had a couple of drinks. That's one version. The other version comes from that. You guys remember that wonderful, awful TV series in the 70s or 80s called Battlestar Galactica?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I mean, well, the Avengers were vipers.
Yeah, exactly. The original one, they were called Vipers, and they kind of looked, again, if you've had a couple martinis, like the F-16, and they had a phrase, you know, launch all Vipers, and I don't know how it stuck to the F-16, but it did, because nobody calls it a fighting Falcon except for the people that make it.
Well, you do know that General Dynamics got sued by Paramount, right?
No, I didn't.
That's the other part of the story.
Really?
Originally, General Dynamics wanted to call it the Viper, and they got sued by Paramount, so therefore we came out with the Fighting Falcon, which nobody calls it.
I never knew that. That's really cool. Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense, too. I'll have something else to answer people when they ask.
Yeah.
See, actually, I knew when you were talking about wild weasels, I actually thought I knew what that was. Because when you said wild weasel, I knew it wasn't my ex-wife because she was just kind of a weasel.
Just kind of a weasel.
That's okay. Yeah, so I just think you're on another topic, but that's all right.
I mean, we could talk with you all night, I know, on this topic. But
how exciting would that be?
Very.
Very. That would be really cool.
You guys aren't blonde and cute, so it couldn't be that exciting.
Well, it could be.
A bar and a lot of beers, I could get.
I wanted to see where you're going to go with that one, Max.
I know.
Yeah, there's not enough martinis that would make me finish that thought. So.
All right, good.
You know why they?
Whoa, that could be. No, really
sure, fun. You could. There's a lot of double entendres in that, mate.
That's where you need to play tuppers,
so to speak. You've lost it now, haven't you?
God, I'm doomed.
All right, you guys want to do a couple of Gorilla Geeks questions? Think we have time?
No.
No.
No, let's do one or two. I just have to get my grunt out
before
we start.